I just want to hear how to construct this killing field. So, we're pleased to have Lars Anderson today from, I'm not sure where you're from anymore.
Stockholm. Stockholm.
Sometimes.
Yeah. Most of the time.
Most of the time. Lars will speak on global existence for 3 plus 1 gravity and its joint work with Vince.
Okay, so I'll just put this up to check the focus and it's so I think some of you have heard me talk about this topic. This is a joint work with Vince Moncrief, but I think I'd like to focus on a few different aspects having to do with the wave equation aspect of the Einstein equations. And I'm certainly no expert on this, but maybe someone can correct me if I make terrible mistakes. And the result that I'm going to talk about, the new result, is a small data global existence result for Einstein's equations in 3 plus 1 dimensions. And it's in the spatially compact case, or the cosmological case. And just to set the notation, let me just show this. So I'm going to denote the space-time with bars, so the space-time manifold and the metric with bars, and it's Lorentzian. And so if we have a space-like hypersurface, then everyone knows that the vacuum equations imply certain constraint equations, and those come from the fact that you have a gauge group, the diffeomorphism group. And we say that the space-time is globally hyperbolic if there is a Cauchy surface. So that means a hypersurface, a spatial hypersurface, such that any inextendable causal curve has to hit this. So basically that determines what goes on in the space-time. Okay, and so just to fix some notions. So I say that, so we call a vacuum extension of a data set M, G, K is a space-time which is vacuum. And it's a vacuum Cauchy extension if it's a vacuum extension and also globally hyperbolic, so that it does have a Cauchy surface. And there's a fundamental theorem that says that given any data on a manifold solving the constraint equations, there is a unique maximal vacuum Cauchy extension. And that's a powerful result, but it doesn't tell you very much about the structure of these space-times. And also, you should note that by examples, if you look at the maximal vacuum extension, that doesn't necessarily have to coincide with the maximal vacuum Cauchy extension. And an example is Taubnut. The Taubnut solution has a smooth Cauchy horizon and is extendable, and the extension is not unique in up to isometry. And so if in those cases predictability fails, you can say, and this should be something that shouldn't hold for generic data unless there is something it seems like that should be an unphysical feature of the Einstein equations. Okay, so there is a conjecture to take care of that, the strong cosmic censorship, and that says that in the case where M is compact, suppose that we take data on a compact manifold. Let's take the maximal vacuum Cauchy extension. Then for generic data, this should be inextendable. So the space-time produced by the Shoukevry-Hargerov result should be the whole story. And basically, as you reach the boundary of this maximal globally hyperbolic space-time, curvature should blow up or something bad should happen. There's a version of this which you can formulate in the asymptotically flat case, where you have observers at infinity, saying that basically any singularity should be hidden from an observer at infinity for generic data. But this is this seems more in line with what I'm going to talk about. And the examples, so we can give two examples to see what's going on. So here is, this is Taubnacht as a spatially homogeneous, the space-like manifold is a sphere. And as you move up in time, basically the one space-like direction becomes null. And behind here, you have closed time-like curves, and you have non-unique extensions. Another simple example where you can actually say something is this case, where so here you have a compact hyperbolic manifold. That means a free manifold Riemannian with a constant sectional curvature negative 1 metric. So this space-time here is a k equal to minus 1 locally Friedman universe, and it's flat. And so that looks like this. It has a big bang, and it expands forever. And in this case, you can actually say that this globally hyperbolic space-time is inextendable, because behind the horizon here, the isometry group of this space-time has fixed points which lie dense. So there cannot be a Hausdorff structure behind the horizon. So here it's not the curvature that's blowing up, because this is a flat space-time. Rather, it's the topology that's causing this space-time to fail to be extendable. Okay. And in this context, I also should mention this BKL conjecture, which is, if you try to rank things, this would be perhaps at the somewhere in intermediate between global existence and cosmic censorship, but certainly most likely equally hard. So here the conjecture is that if you take generic data and look at this maximal global hyperbolic extension, typically in this spatially compact case, there is going to be a singularity, and such a singularity is going to be local, space-like, and oscillatory. And what that means is that the singularity should be to the future or the past of an observer. Observers should be causally separated at the singularity, and each observer should see some kind of oscillatory behavior, which and the model you should have in mind is MixMaster, where you undergo an infinite number of bounces caused by curvature potentials. And this picture is supported by numerical experiments for symmetric cases. U1 symmetric Gaudi, that means T2 symmetric with some matter, and the people who have done this work are Beverly Berger, Jim Eisenberg, Moncrief, and others. And recently the Bianchi case, which was open, was partly at least settled by Hans Ringström, who showed that in that case...
What is Bianchi case?
The Bianchi case is where you have a metric that's spatially homogeneous.
So, irrespective of the type?
Excuse me?
Irrespective of which Bianchi type, that's spatially homogeneous?
Spatially homogeneous. So the result here is for Bianchi class A, vacuum. Bianchi class A vacuum. And what you show there is that, let's say for Bianchi type 9, which is the MixMaster universe, there either you have this Taubnacht solution, or at the singularity, the Kretschmann scalar, the square of the curvature blows up. So there is a dichotomy. And in particular, unless you have a Taubnacht solution, the space-time cannot be extendable, since the curvature blows up at the singularity. And somehow that's a very, very simple case of this general picture.
Is Bianchi 8 registered yet?
Yeah, it's a similar story. Okay, so I'm always talking about vacuum. So if you add matter, for example, if you add a scalar field, this behavior is expected to change. And a scalar field will essentially prevent this oscillatory behavior from happening. Okay, so now all of these questions are extremely hard, and no one is even close to understanding any of it. But you can at least try to study the global structure of spacetimes using the evolution equations. So this is part of the action equations here. And this evolution system plus the constraint is basically the vacuum Einstein equation. And you can try to, if you're given data, you can try to construct the maximal vacuum Cauchy extension by proving global existence for this system in a suitable gauge. And you have to be careful about which gauge you choose. For example, if you choose Gauss coordinates, so laps equal to, this is the laps here, laps equal to 1, then you can have focusing, or you will have focusing. And for example, trace k equal to 0, that has this feature that you have the collapse of the laps. So the foliation will avoid singularities, and therefore the foliation will not cover the entire space-time. And that's a known fact, for example, in Schwarzschild. So you can have these gauge pathologies. So now the good gauge condition, or what one would like to believe is the good gauge condition, is this. It's a CMC gauge. So you have trace K on the hypersurface. K is the second fundamental form. It's constant. And there is a conjecture, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say that this is due to Early and Moncrief, but I'll say it anyway. Because there have been counterexamples thrown about. So take a globally hyperbolic space-time with a compact CMC Cauchy surface, then this is globally foliated by CMC hypersurfaces. And CMC hypersurfaces are nice because the mean curvature operator satisfies the strong maximum principle. So you can construct these using a variational argument and barriers. And in fact, if you know that this space-time is such that you have a crushing singularity, that means that you have Cauchy surfaces with mean curvature going off to plus and minus infinity, then you do have a global CMC foliation. And in fact, you also know that from this maximum principle that in the spatially compact case, mean curvature is monotone. So, and you have uniqueness for CMC hypersurfaces. Yeah. Well, I mean, there are two aspects. First of all, so this is again in the vacuum case. So there are counterexamples of spacetimes without a CMC Cauchy surface, which have matter in them, and there are also recently by Jim and Alan Randall examples where you have dust, and the dust has a singularity which prevents you from having global CMC foliation, I think. But this is always in the vacuum case.
But the thing that you just said is not a confident example.
No, it's no. Assumption. Yes.
The collapse and lapse phenomena presumably prevents these classes from really foliating the whole space-time in the black hole, which it surprises me we ever conjectured.
Well, I'm afraid you did. So, that's why I'm giving you a chance to take it back. Okay, and so the heuristic picture is that you have the following the following situation, and I hope that I got this right. So you have two cases, either, depending on the topology, either you have a Big Bang and a Big Crunch, or a Big Bang and infinite expansion. And this depends on the Yamabe type. I mean, which signs of constant scalar curvature metrics the space-like manifold M admits. And this is known, this recollapse, there's a recollapse conjecture that says that if you have certain topologies, you have to have a Big Crunch. But that's only known in the Bianchi case. And even there, it's a hard problem. So the only result I know is that for Bianchi 9, you do have recollapse, and that was
more generally about.
Yeah, so I'll mention some of that.
Because Vince said you can consider
right, that's all.
For many cosmology, right?
Right, so then
only. No.
No, it was back.
Only the recollapse,
no.
Recollapse, graviton, and
what? Right. So is this doing
two-person
dimensions? I mean, really, generally.
I mean, this is certainly going to give you good foliation for cosmology.
The point here is that you have, this is a spatially compact hypersurface, and it's not, certainly not clear that you have this collapse of the lapse phenomenon in this situation.
Well, if you isolated enough ball of matter, you're going to have a black hole. You can form a black hole that's small in the cosmological scale, it'll collapse.
But this is, when you do personal dimensions, you did this work, and then it's true that, you know, this is 48 by constant curvature, or was that an assumption? Or?
Two plus one, well, in pure 2+1, yeah, Lars and I have global foliations in that case. But that's 2+1 in the 2+1 sense, of course, even though you can regard the space sense as 3+1 with a killing field.
Okay, and then in, what is the story in the asymptotic flat case where you could just have. Did
Bartnik
have zero results in that case?
No, in the asymptotically flat case, the result is that there you do have this collapse of the lapse. It may or may not happen in the cosmological case. Well, heuristically, that is true. But the point is that these foliations never actually reach trace k equal to zero. They always have, you know, they always have non-zero trace k, so they're always marching forward better than a trace k equal to zero. So I don't know. It may or may not be true.
But were there any results that cater to this problem that everybody's saying? We said that the curvature is then bound there or something. I mean, I remember some results of Bartnik.
So let me mention.
There are the Barry results.
Yeah, so let me mention, so here, if you look at the CMC, at the circle, so let me tell you exactly what I know about this. So the only cases for vacuum where you know you have global CMC foliations, unless you have this assumption of a crushing singularity, is the Bianchi case and the 1+1 Gaudi case. So the 1+1 dimension is the dimension of the reduced space-time. And this is a result, this is obvious, and this is a result due to, well, more or less obvious, and this is a result due to Vince and Jim. And otherwise, if you have spherical symmetry, then you have to have matter, for example, a scalar field. And there it's known, due to work of Rendell, that in the certain, at least in a certain topology, you have global existence in CMC time. So that means a global CMC foliation. And then, of course, Christodoulou studied the spherically symmetric case and proved weak cosmic censorship. In that case, in the R3 equals R1. So that's what's known. So one can at least pose this global existence problem and say that So to study the properties of the maximal vacuum Cauchy extension of a certain data set, you can try to construct a foliation that covers the entire maximum vacuum extension and do this in a suitable gauge. And the candidate for that is this CNC gauge. So that's something one can try. Okay. So that's the situation. And so there are a number of results for symmetric space times. There is for vacuum 2 plus 1, there is a global existence result. And apart from that, there are small data results, and that's what I'm going to talk about for the rest of the talk. So what I'd like to do is to go back to looking for a while at the Einstein equation as a wave equation and compare it to other wave equations where things are known. Okay, so let's think back to the proof of this Schuck-Abraham-Gerow theorem. So this is a standard fact that if you go to these wave-like or space-time harmonic coordinates, then the vacuum equation becomes a non-linear wave equation, and you have the wave operator in the metric acting on the metric components. You have a quadratic term in the derivatives of the metric. And so local existence is standard, and by Zorn's lemma type argument, you get this maximal global hyperbolic extension. And you also get uniqueness, but that uses the Hausdorff, the assumption that the spacetime is Hausdorff. And for such quasi-linear wave equations, the well-postedness for the Cauchy problem in Sobolev spaces is standard. But those standard results don't tell you anything about global existence. So, and now I'm getting into things I only know about from others, basically. So if you look at a wave equation like this, this is on Minkowski space. This has global existence for small data in 3 plus 1 dimensions. And this does not. And the reason is that the nonlinearity has a particular structure. So if this quadratic form here kills null vectors. So if you stick in a plane wave into this nonlinearity, it has better decay than what you would expect. And we say that such quadratic forms satisfy the null condition, if that's true. And there's a general, you can prove general theorems along these lines, that if you have a nonlinear wave equation which has this null condition, then you have small data global existence in 3 plus 1 dimensions. And small data in this case means small data really close to zero, I mean in some Sobolev space sense. On the other hand, this equation, which doesn't satisfy the null condition, does not have global existence for small data. You can actually find initial data with finite lifetime for this equation. And the message is that the null condition is somehow needed to have small data global existence. Or in more physical terms, to have nonlinear stability around a trivial solution. Because that's what this is, in some sense, what this is about. So now we can, so let me mention a few other examples. So this is a well-known type of equation. You take a map from Minkowski space into a Riemannian manifold, and you write down this equation, which is sometimes known as a nonlinear sigma model. And the gammas here are the Christoffel symbols of the target. So this is a semi-linear wave equation. It does have this null structure because here I'm contracting the gradient of u with the space-time metric. And of course the gamma depends on u here as well. And let me just mention what's known about this. So in the 1 plus 1 case, global existence is not hard. And in fact, you can show that this is well posed in HS cross HS minus 1, S bigger than 3 quarters. So, yeah.
So you're assuming the target space is a positive definite metric?
Yes, yes. Because otherwise I think there are no results. May not be impossible. Okay, and so here HS means S derivatives in L2. So here you have to use some Fourier analysis to define these spaces. But the point here is that the system is actually well posed not only in energy norm but in bigger spaces. Energy norm corresponds to H1 cross H0 or H1 cross L2. But here it's actually weaker than that. And for the higher dimensions, the thing is well posed in HS cross HS minus 1, S bigger than N halves. And this is due to the fact that you have this null condition. The story is that global existence fails for the dimension higher than 3, higher than or equal to 3, and it's open for N equals to 2. And it's an interesting thing is that for N equal to 2, if you actually can remove this sharp inequality here, then you get energy norm. And since energy is conserved, that gives a global existence for free. And this is somehow a very attractive idea that conservation of energy gives you global existence once you have proved well postedness for the Cauchy problem in a sufficiently weak space. Well, because, I mean, suppose that you are able to prove that the Cauchy problem is well posed under the assumption that the energy norm is finite.
Then
it would follow, and that's exactly what I'm saying. On the other hand, this argument doesn't apply if you know only in n equals to 2, then n halves is 1. So this would be energy norm plus epsilon, so to speak. And then you don't get anywhere. Then it's a nice result, but it doesn't give you a global existence. And the small data results are proved using, you know, really completely different techniques. And the other famous nonlinear equation is the Yang-Mills equation. And there it's interesting to note that there are two completely different strategies for proving global existence. On the one hand, there is a proof using a priori estimates, a priori maximum norm estimates, using energy conservation, light cone integrals, and a special gauge where you can reconstruct the connection from the curvature, called the radial or Kronström gauge. And that's due to Erdely and Moncrief. So that's a completely different vein from this other proof, which uses this idea that I talked about earlier, namely to prove well-postedness in energy norm and then get global existence from the conservation of energy. And that was done by Kleinemann and Macedon. And the central thing is that Yang-Mills in Coulomb gauge satisfies a certain type of null condition, which you have to work a lot to exploit that. But this is the gauge they used. And they were able to prove well postness in locally in space in Coulomb gauge, and then use that to prove global existence.
In both these cases, the gauge loses conductor.
Yes. And so neither of these cases, it doesn't look easy to generalize to Yang-Mills, to Einstein, even though the structure of Einstein equations is really very close to Yang-Mills equation, certainly in vacuum, where the contracted Bianchi identity looks exactly like Yang-Mills. So it's interesting to see if that allows you to find a null condition for Einstein equations. So and then finally let's look at the Einstein equations, and there it's not so nice, because if you take this wave-like or space-like harmonic coordinates, space-time harmonic coordinates gauge, then and write out the Einstein equation, it looks something like this. So you have the wave operator on the metric, there is some term with derivatives on the outside, and then there is a term that satisfies the null condition. And so in fact, the Einstein equation doesn't satisfy the null condition in this wave-like gauge, and there is no gauge known where it does satisfy the null condition. But there are two interesting things that you can mention here. On one hand, there is a weak field analysis of post-Minkowskian perturbation theory, where you can see that this very term can be put to zero by going to a suitable non-local gauge. And in some sense, the idea is that this gauge change takes into account the way the light cones move around from Minkowski to Schwarzschild when you do a perturbation around flat space. So that's very, very heuristic, but to some extent true. And the other situation, this is the weak field. The other situation is if you look at high frequency perturbations, and this is something that was studied a lot many years ago. If you take a perturbation like this, so you have a background metric, and then a small high frequency perturbation, and you let you scale this so that epsilon times omega goes to 1, frequency goes to infinity, then you, in a certain limit, you can argue that the equation boils down to Einstein equation with a null fluid. So this is like the gravitons or something like that, a radiation fluid. And this, you can see by going through the analysis, that this term does come from this term that violates the null condition in Einstein equations in the space-time harmonic gauge.
Are we supposed to understand that these are directly related to that problem, or is it just a problem?
Well, this is, I mean, because the situation is this, that it is known in several cases that this small data global existence does hold for Einstein equations. However, the message from these other results on nonlinear wave equations is that you can only have global existence for small data in 3 plus 1 dimensions if you do have the null condition satisfied.
But is there any hope of actually using, for example, the weak field analysis, or is it just
a... No, this is just, I mean, I think this is sort of an interesting thing to think about, but I don't know how to use it. But this is somehow understanding this behavior is, I think, is central. to really making progress. Because all of these results about well postedness for weak initial data, they do use the null condition.
So does it work either way? So if you don't have the null condition, you definitely know that there's going to be a problem?
I don't know.
No,
I don't think so.
Now, doesn't case where it doesn't happen, but in most cases it's like this, when one can prove the
okay, so that's the background on nonlinear wave equations, and so I'll just mention very quickly the small data global existence results that are known for Einstein's equations. So I'm not sure about which order, but let me start with the Christodoulou-Kleinmann result. And what they say is that if you take data which are close to flat, to the data induced on a flat hypersurface in Minkowski space, in with sufficient regularity, then the maximal vacuum Cauchy extension is geodesically complete and asymptotically Minkowskian in the sense that the curvature tensor dies off, but you don't have a regular scry, or at least they were not able to prove it. And the mechanism here is that you have your gravitational energy radiates off to infinity, and if you have a small perturbation here, it's going to decay to flat space and not cause any singularities.
So they don't know whether they this has a regular scry or not, or they were actually able to show that things don't fall.
Well, I mean, I think they are claiming. I'm not sure if it's written down that. For their data, the scry isn't going to be regular, and they have almost all of the components of the Weyl tensor decaying at the right rate, but not all of them. And you shouldn't really ask me.
I don't know. I don't know the latest, but when the first came out, there was no convincing that there's not a limitation of the matter as opposed to
but this would be a real blow to the whole idea of the scry, right? These solutions
don't think so.
You don't think so?
No, I mean, it's also made for the but my present understanding is that you possibly have to impose some strong cutoff condition, and then there might be something that is smooth. And I don't think that would be a blow to the whole idea.
But also, I mean, that's my number one. My number two is that. Even if the sky, I mean, that sky was regular enough to define body energy. It's not that there's a magical little G0 there or something. It's regular enough to define body energy. But that sky is also not regular enough to define angular momentum. Right?
Yeah.
So it's not.
So it's reasonable to ask if you impose a finite, is it possible to impose a finite number of conditions or some extra decay conditions that cure this problem? But as far as I understand, that's not yet resolved.
In that book, they speculate that it's impossible.
Yeah. And you know, sometimes you will find Kleinmann making.
You don't agree with that. No.
So sometimes you can find Kleinmann making the two conjectures that, on the one hand, there is a finite number of conditions. On the other hand, that the only solution, the only vacuum spacetime that satisfies the Penrose condition is Minkowski space. But I really don't have an opinion about that.
I mean, when it first came out, we had long sessions with the members about trying to really understand which way it is. And that is everybody in the room nobody in the room could be convinced that this was a real result as opposed to limitation of the matter.
Okay, and so that's the one result. The next result is due to Helmut, and that's so after talking a lot to Kleinmann, he always calls it half global, because he's very particular about this, that their result is global, and this is in some sense global to the future. And so the situation here is that you take you take so here, this is Minkowski space that's conformal to this this diamond, which has a regular null boundary. And what you can, so what after a really so lengthy calculation, you can write down a first order symmetric hyperbolic system which involves the metric, the Christoffel symbols, the Weyl tensor, and the conformal factor, and which extends regularly across this null boundary. And then you pose initial data on a hypersurface like this and evolve to the future. And then the small data result becomes the question of Cauchy stability. And then you have to, so then the harder part, or still harder part, is to prove that you have a regular and complete scrying up and up to and including this the future time-like infinity. So that's a small data result that where you put data close to a standard hyperboloid, close to the data induced on a standard hyperboloid in Minkowski space. Okay, and then finally, I mentioned this result due to Vince and myself. So this is a small data, and it's half global existence in the same sense that Helmut's result is. That is to say that we prove something about the future of a Cauchy surface. And to state that, so let's, a Kodaty tensor is a tensor, a symmetric two-tensor that satisfies this equation. So this is like a covariant exterior derivative on two tensors. And a hyperbolic three-manifold, that's to say with a sectional curvature negative one metric, and I forgot to put here compact. So a compact hyperbolic three-manifold. We call it rigid if there is no trace-free Kodaty tensor except the trivial one. And recall that hyperbolic metrics are rigid on a compact three-manifold because of Nostow rigidity. There is a unique one. But that rigidity doesn't hold if you allow yourself to deform in the class of flat conformal structures, or indeed if you allow yourself to deform the corresponding space-time through flat space-times. But let's just assume this for the moment. So the theorem is like this, that suppose you have a rigid compact hyperbolic three-manifold, then there is an epsilon bigger than zero, so that for initial data solving the vacuum constraints with constant mean curvature initially, and it's by some orientation fix it to be smaller than zero, then if the data are close enough to standard data on one of these cone space-times with metric with this kind of metric, then the maximal vacuum Cauchy extension is globally foliated by CMC hypersurfaces to the future of this initial surface, and furthermore it's geodesically complete in the expanding direction. So this is like a nonlinear stability result for these expanding locally k equal to minus 1 Friedmann universes. And the picture is like this. So in the expanding direction you have it's causally geodesically complete. The metric actually decays to this flat cone metric. You have a global CMC foliation in this region, and by scaling we can arrange so that the Kretschmann scalar initially is as large as you like, because that scales differently than the energies that we use in this proof. And by the standard singularity theorems, these spacetimes have to contain a singularity in the collapsing direction. And furthermore, we can show that this cone metric, this is somehow there's an instability in the collapsing direction, in the sense that you have to leave any, starting as close as you like to the standard data, moving in the direction of the singularity, you have to leave, there is a neighborhood of that standard data that you have to leave. So in that sense you have to, this is an unstable solution in the direction of the singularity. Okay, and the proof, the ingredients of the proof, we use Bell-Robinson energy estimates, and I'll say something about that. We prove local existence in H3 cross H2 for this, for the evolution and constraint system, in a certain gauge, which is a combination of CMC and spatial harmonic coordinates. And then we use a continuation principle for that, for this system, to ensure that once we have the energy under control, then unless that blows up, we can continue the foliation for as long as possible.
Do you know that the initial singularity has to be spatialized?
No. No, I mean that would be asking too much, because somehow the only thing we know is that the metric has to leave a neighborhood of the standard data, so to speak.
The curve is getting big.
Yeah, but we don't even know that. I think that's all of those are much harder questions than this small data result.
The fact that you have to leave is all going back. Well. Right, once you leave, if you don't know
where
it can't
re-enter
the ball, so,
no,
you're right.
Yeah, it's difficult to say anything.
And there's no modus the evolution of Bell-Robinson doesn't tell you whether it's going to get bigger?
Well, we can't really say anything. Once it gets big enough, then we can't really say anything.
Yeah.
So that might be worth looking at. Okay. So the picture of these standard space times, the picture you should have is this, that they are constructed by taking a quotient of the interior of the light cone, and by letting the fundamental group of M act on the standard hyperboloids in here, you get these compact hyperbolic manifolds, and you get this cone space time. And the fact is that if you look at these trace-free Kodaty tensors, we have the following. If you look at that space, the dimension is the same as the moduli space of flat conformal structures, and also the same as the dimension of the moduli space of flat space-times with the given topology. And there is a theorem that says that there is a non-empty class of compact hyperbolic manifolds which are rigid in the sense that I mentioned. And this was proved in the setting of flat conformal structures. But since one can prove that those dimensions are the same, that also holds for the Kodaty tensors. And just an example of this this non-rigidity, you can see that like this. So one example where you do have non-rigidity is if M contains a totally geodesic hypersurface. Then if you think of this hyperbolic manifold as coming from a hyperboloid in Minkowski space, then the universal cover of this hypersurface corresponds to a hyperplane in Minkowski space. So you can cut the light cone according to this bad picture, with this hyperplane, pull it apart and glue in a wedge like this, and then the group action still acts, the group still acts on this, and you get a compact, you get a spatially compact globally hyperbolic quotient, and that is now a deformation of the original space-time. And there's going to be, in general, a finite dimensional family, a moduli space of these things.
So do you think your result doesn't hold in this case, or you just can't prove it?
Well, we think it holds, but we don't know yet how to prove it. And the reason is that the energies we're using are non-degenerate, exactly in the case where you have this rigidity holds. And because here somehow you can move around without costing you any, without actually changing the curvature.
Can you remind us what this dimension was the same as the dimension of the moduli space
of flat conformal structures on the three manifold? And the reason is that the reason is basically that if you look at the structure of the Lie algebra of SO41 and SO31 cross R4, they both contain an SO31 factor, and then you have this infinitesimal rigidity, and the, what's left over has the same dimension. So the formal tangent space is the same. The only difference is that here I can prove that this moduli space is a manifold, but that's not known for the flat conformal structures. So there's some kind of Teichmuller space floating around here. Okay. And so the central thing in the proof is that in the asymptotic flat case, we have this decay due to the gravitational energy radiating away. But in the spatially compact case, it's the expansion of this cone space-time, or maybe the cosmological redshift that gives the decay, which makes it possible to get global existence. So if you look at a linearized perturbation, if you restrict yourself to perturbations which are non-trivial with respect to gauge, then the linearized Ricci tensor is just the wave equation on this background, the covariant wave equation. And if you work out in the separation of variables how those linearized solutions look, I think this is the result. And you see that corresponding to the Laplacian on two tensors, on trace-free, divergence-free two tensors, has this, the spectrum looks like this. It's -3, minus something. And this mu is zero precisely for these Kodaty tensors. So you have some terms here corresponding to the Kodaty tensors, others to the higher mu's. And for the Kodaty tensors, there is this T log T term, which has somehow too slow decay, slower decay than it should. And this is, in fact, this is present only in three plus one dimensions. But you see that these linearized perturbations, they have a certain amount of decay, which makes you hope that you can actually prove some non-linear stability result. Okay, so time is getting short. So I think I'll just mention very briefly the main object that we're working with in the proof, and that is this Bell-Robinson energy. And to motivate that, let's look at the sort of Hamiltonian energies that you can have for GR. So there's the ADM mass, which is the value of the Hamiltonian when you restrict yourself to the constraint set in the asymptotically flat case. In the spatially compact case, you can write down some kind of So then if you fix gauge, the Hamiltonian acquires a value. It's otherwise it would be zero. And this is one version of this Hamiltonian. And this particular thing is dimensionless, time-dependent, and monotone. But all of these are basically analogous to the usual energy. So it's a H1 plus L2. That's the most you can hope to bound with these. On the other hand, if you look at the local contribution to quasi-local mass, so most standard definitions give you the same answer, that if you look at the quasi-local mass for a very small sphere and scale it accordingly, then you pick out precisely the Bell-Robinson tensor. So the contribution from a point to the mass is in some sense the Bell-Robinson tensor, or components of the Bell-Robinson tensor. And this is the Bell-Robinson tensor. So it's quadratic in the Weyl tensor. And it has many nice features. Let's see here. Okay. So you can analyze this for a general Weyl field, so a trace-free tensor with the symmetries of the Riemann. Then you form this Q, the Bell-Robinson tensor as before. And what you find is that it's totally symmetric, trace-free, and non-negative in this sense, that if you contract it four times with a time-like vector, it's non-negative and zero if and only if the Weyl tensor vanishes. So now you can write down an energy expression which is not going to be conserved but which has a conservation law. You can compute the time derivative. And if you're in vacuum, then of course the Weyl tensor is just the Riemann tensor, so that satisfies the Bianchi identities. So here are certain components of the Weyl tensor corresponding to the electric and magnetic part. If you write down this expression that we had here, that's quadratic in the E and the B, so that's like electromagnetism. And you should note that the Ricci tensor is basically the Laplacian on the metric, so this energy bounds H2 cross H1. And that's still not enough to have a well-posed Cauchy problem for gravity, even though there is a conjecture by Kleinemann that says that this is the right norm for the Cauchy problem for gravity, but that's very far from being understood. Okay. And so I'm almost out of time here. So let me just... Yeah, so I can say it in words. So the story is like this. We compute, we write down, so let's see here. So we define a higher order, a differentiated Weyl tensor like that. That's another Weyl field. You can, using the Einstein equations, you can relate the E and the B corresponding to this W1 to the old E and the B, like this. So that's like the the Maxwell equations, some version of the Maxwell equations. So
are you using the gauge in this trace field for
this? Yes, yes. So now the statement is that suppose that we're in this gauge where we have trace k equal to constant spatial harmonic coordinates, then write down this version of the energy. Here T is trace k. So rescale the energy like this. Then the energy in the rigid case dominates the H3 cross H2 norm.
Okay.
And so if you have small, this is in the small data case. So if you have small data, the energy dominates the Sobolev norms. And therefore, if you control the energy, you control the Sobolev norms, and you can extend the solution for all time that's possible. And so I'll just show the final result here. So for this energy, we prove using various interpolation inequalities and Sobolev estimates that you have a differential inequality like this. And this term is due to using interpolation to take care of terms which are basically L4 in the E and the B fields. So we get this nonlinear differential inequality. Look at the model equation. That's the corresponding ODE that you get by putting equality here. That has global existence for small data. So this means that the energy can't blow up if you have small data initially. And in fact, you see that the energy, if you have small data initially, the energy has to decay like order mean curvature squared as you go in the expanding direction. And now, since we know that the energy controls the H3 cross H2 norm, we have a well posedness for the Cauchy problem in this gauge in H3 cross H2. Then we can extend the time of existence for any value of t smaller than zero. And that, what that means is that since t is mean curvature, that means that we cover the entire future of this universe. And then so then a different argument shows you that given this control over the geometry, you can then show that causal geodesics are complete in the future direction. Okay, so I think that's what all I had to say.
Last time, not this one, the one before,
you had
the theory about in the rigid case, this uses a bound.
Let's see here. This, yeah.
So I feel confused. So, supposing a rigidity fails, then I could have an extrinsic curvature, for example, which gives me zero p, and not given extrinsic curvature. But there is still a contribution of the energy coming from the electric part.
In case M is not rigid, then you can actually write down. So suppose that I make a perturbation so that the perturbation in the metric is H, or I mean so the condition is like this. I'm not sure I remember this exactly, but this is a trace tree. So this basically the moduli space of these flat space times is exactly if you linearize, so the kernel, so if you try to solve D, E, and B equal to zero. Where this is the perturbation, the linearization of the E and the B at this standard data. The space of solutions is exactly the space of tracery Kodaly tensors. And so that means that unless I have this rigidity condition, this inequality simply won't hold. Because I can write down tensors where it fails. But now, on the other hand, the idea is that what we're hoping to do is to add something suitable, like for example this rescaled Hamiltonian. Uh, which is another, this energy is dimensionless. This is another dimensionless quantity. It's monotone in the, monotone decreasing in the, is it increasing or decreasing? Increasing, decreasing. It's monotone decreasing in the expanding direction. And if you look at the perturbation of this, this will give you a contribution which kills off the kernel of this, So the sum of this plus this rescaled energy is going to be non-degenerate, and so one can hope that this will be enough to get the full result. But we also know from this linearized analysis that in the case, in the non-rigid case, you can have linearized perturbations which have a logarithmic decay rather than just a power law decay. In fact, we don't know if this is going to work, but I expect it will.
And what are the reasons to go to this modified energy versus Deb Robinson?
Oh.
You don't get a good
Well, because first of all, we need to add this higher order term, because the Bell-Robinson itself doesn't control high enough Sobolev norms. On the other hand, we need to get to this rescaled energy, because since we have this the expansion of the underlying metric causes the Sobolev constants and so on to degenerate, and we need to estimate things in a dimensionless way. And this seems to be the right choice.